Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for January 17th, 2010. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a newscast in it. The big story is that Google has announced its intent to end censorship and potentially even pull its operations out of China. Also, the benefits of viewing source and its potentially endangered future. An interview with a Facebook insider reveals potential internal privacy concerns, and another discussion of icons for free Libre and open source licenses. All of this and more. First, though, I wanted to give a quick apology for the quality of my voice, and I hope it actually manages to hold out for the entire show. Late last night, I started to come down with something, and while I, for the most part, still feel pretty good, my sinuses and my throat are a bit crudded up, so we'll see how well they do, and hopefully you don't find the extra gravel in my voice all that distracting. The other thing I wanted to talk about very briefly is just to mention that I'm lining up my convention schedule for the coming year. These are our science fiction conventions exclusively so far, as the plans I have laid out have them, and they're ones where I'm both volunteering and participating as a panelist. The first one coming up the weekend of February 12th, 13th, and 14th is Farpoint. That will be on the north side of Baltimore in Timonium. In May, Memorial Day weekend, that will be Balticon, which is in that same general area, Hunt Valley, just north of Baltimore. And in late August, early September, Labor Day, of course, is DragonCon, the big one. Those are the only three I have planned to go to so far, mostly because of the costs involved with some of the other ones. And ShmooCon, which I dearly would have liked to have gone to next month, I just could not get a ticket. Apparently, it is a very hot event this year, ShmooCon 6. And as much as I would like to go, it's our local hacking convention here in D.C., tickets sold out in all three rounds in absolutely record time. So that's kind of where it leaves me. I have another project spinning up soon, which I'll talk about when I'm a little bit more ready, which also is going to consume some of my travel time. So there may be some opportunity to overlap and expand into other events in the course of doing that as well. Of course, part of the reason that I mentioned my travels, my convention plans in particular, is that if you're considering going to any of the three that I mentioned, any future events that I talk about on the show, or write up on the blog, I'd very much like to meet listeners, meet people of similar mind and interest. In particular, last year at Balticon, I had a short, sort of small birds of a feather session Friday night before the con itself really kind of got full in swing. That turned out quite well. We had a fair number of people turn out for that, both listeners and just friends and acquaintances. And I'll be looking to do that at Balticon specifically again. But beyond that, if, as I say, any of you are in town or in the area as I'm traveling, feel free to let me know and we'll try to schedule a meetup or get together. That would be particularly nice. Like many of you, I have a home network and several systems to secure, so I follow reports of security vulnerabilities with special interest. Each week, I pick a couple of those to talk about here, both to cement them in my mind and to raise some awareness. The only security alert I wanted to talk about this week, and I wanted to give it a bit more time to discuss, is this interview that many blogs have picked up, including Boing Boing. Jenny Jardin linked to this. And it's a discussion of internal privacy breaches or concerns, as we have it from a Facebook insider. Some of the facts here aren't really actually that big a deal. I think people are blowing them up a little bit, probably starting off with the fact that Facebook errs on the side of retaining information. They essentially, as this internal source says it, don't delete anything. They have also, not surprisingly, even recently started to mine that information, looking for ways that they can kind of build patterns and relationships out of that to better drive their ad activity, just from the course of what they're gathering in their users' normal usage and activity on the site. What probably has everybody up in arms the most, though, is the discussion around this master password. This is one that would let anyone on staff who knew it access any profile as if they were that user, so completely overriding any privacy settings. There are a couple of things here that are important to note. That the interviewee claims it is no longer used, first and foremost. This is something that the company used to do as they were spinning the technology up. And that this particular capability was very carefully limited to only work from Facebook's internal networks. So if it were leaked, if somebody were able to figure out the permutation of the name Chuck Norris, I found it kind of surprising that that much even was revealed about what it was. It was some odd spelling with alphanumeric characters and non-alphanumeric characters. If you've crafted any kind of a strong password, you know what I'm talking about in terms of substitutions that make those spellings obvious to a person but hard to guess. This is actually not a very unusual practice. I have been at startups with similar capabilities built into the service offering. What she describes as a replacement, though, makes more sense and is a better way to go about this from a support perspective and operational perspective. What she actually describes in the interview is something kind of like a sudo, if you're familiar with that Linux or Unix superuser tool or utility. It now actually generates an audit trail when people log in and assume the identity of an existing profile on Facebook, and it's clearly much more aimed at support and engineering purposes. It would still be possible, obviously, to abuse this, but any abuse should be much more evident than the old master password that's described in the piece. A couple of other things to temper concern over these sorts of capabilities, which it's stressed repeatedly in the interview that these are for engineering or for support purposes, is that folks that were discovered by management at Facebook to be abusing these capabilities were fired. This was a terminatable offense. The interview glosses over, though, something that's it admits is equally, if not more concerning, that is the possibility of direct database access. And speaking from my own experience, that can actually more easily be audited than application capabilities built in by the engineers. This is, of course, assuming that they are using an off-the-shelf database rather than a hand-rolled solution. And this kind of access is also like that master password, or now what's supplanted at this kind of customer support capability, is not that uncommon at startups. More mature organizations actually will develop procedures around such access, and there are even certifying bodies like SAS that come in and help organizations document how they're doing secure handling of customer data, and then will publish a certified document that the company does, basically the audit say that they do what they say that they do, does what it says on the tin, as it were, so that if you have customers in certain sectors that are concerned, and usually not just the general consuming public, usually government or sensitive organizations, then a service provider like Facebook or the ones that I work for could come in with this document in hand and say, we do have procedures in place to audit, to make sure people don't have any more access than they should. And I really wish the interview here actually dug into that context a little bit more. I can understand why people are getting a little up in arms over this and getting a little concerned and maybe are more prodded to actually delete or minimize their profiles on Facebook as a consequence. Setting aside the outward concerns about their privacy policies and the recent quotations from Mark Zuckerberg, I have to think that the management team at Facebook actually is looking into these sorts of certifications and best practices, based especially on, I would say, how they eliminated that problematic master password chatter around engineering and replaced it with something that was much more accountable. For me, this piece really doesn't add to my concerns. I mean, I do have some considerable concerns about Facebook when it comes to privacy and the protection of my information, my expectation of how it's going to be handled. This doesn't make those any greater, mind you. That external privacy handling far outweighs this discussion of oddities and internal access. Internal access to your data is pretty much going to be a given for a managed offering like this, for a third-party service where your data exists wholly on their servers, on their systems. Not that it hasn't been a problem. I mean, Twitter has had several very notable high-profile breaches that happened because of poor password handling. It seems like that's maybe not as much a concern. As I said, the old master password, it's pretty clear from the discussion, was not something that, if leaked, could be used outside of Facebook. Now, I'm sure a sophisticated hacker could work around that, but I don't think these are equivalent to the kinds of much more clumsy mistakes that we've seen covered in the news committed by Twitter. This would be one reason, though, to push for data portability and autonomous interoperable applications. Like in the realm of Twitter, we actually have direct counterparts in the open source realm that you can run yourself, like StatusNet. When it comes to blogs and other offerings, there are some alternatives out there. You can run your own WordPress instance and keep a hold of your data and make sure that there's nobody out there using a master password or some other facility to get at it. The only way you could rule out the sort of internal staff access by another operator, really, is if you're willing to stand up and run such a service yourself. Here are the news that caught my eye this week. For more, check out the website, thecommandline.net. The first story I have is definitely the biggest news story in the tech blogosphere in the past week, and quite possibly one of the largest stories in some time. This is news that Google is going to end censorship of its services in China. This is according to a post on their public policy blog, which was cross-posted from their main blog. It was written by David Drummond, Special SVP of Corporate Development and Chief Legal Officer. Google starts off by describing the attack on its networks, which apparently took place back in December. In the intervening time, they have been working to investigate the source and effect of this and to harden targeted systems. This apparently was one of many such attacks, but somehow this was different from other attacks that happen against Google and other high-profile targets like them, just as a matter of course, as normal operation. Part of the goal of the attack apparently was theft of intellectual property. The original posting doesn't really go into what it was that was stolen, but other accounts suggest that it may have been critical source code, not just from Google, but from the 20 or 30 so other companies that were targeted. The goal seemed to be getting access in particular at Google to email accounts of Chinese dissidents and activists, and was not, according to Google, according to their post, successful at this goal. They only accessed two accounts, and for those two, only information about the accounts, when they were started up, when they were last accessed, and some subject lines of messages exchanged, but not any content of actual messages. Unrelated to this, they realized that many activist accounts had been accessed recently, most likely through phishing scams or other such attacks, not through any sort of breach of Google systems. That's why I said unrelated. At least this is according to their own admission. Google not only has updated its systems to better protect against these sorts of attacks, against phishing and more direct attacks on their systems, but is using this as an opportunity to reevaluate its business operations in China. They explain they initially thought that accepting some censorship was worth the possibility of improving access, improving the lot of the typical Chinese citizen, and supporting the potential huge upside of the economic boom currently going in China. In light of the attack, though, and the wider espionage effort that it's uncovered, Google has decided to review its operations. They will stop censoring their results immediately, effectively no longer cooperating with the Chinese government. They may, in the course of that review, decide to pull out of China altogether if they cannot come to an accord with the government and operate the way that they want to, their services operating them legally in that country without censorship, that is. Wired also has an excellent article, which, according to it, Google is clearly bracing for the worst here. Its employees in China have been subject to interrogations before, and in this instance, the timing of Google's announcement this past week was such that the employees on the ground would hear about it before the start of the workday so they could take appropriate measures. According to Wired's source, many of the targeted companies also knew and specifically decided to keep this latest set of attacks under wraps. Google apparently decided to go public to alert the activist community. Their concern now for free speech appears to be, at least on some levels, genuine. The fact that they are working with activists to try to protect them and let them know what's going on. There is almost a subtext, a current of remorse, I think. Maybe this is just me reading into that. Like, they should have known better. You know, getting into a deal like many people have criticized them over the past handful of years. They should have known that something like this would happen. And they're only realizing now that no economic potential was worth supporting this kind of pervasive and insidious censorship of the internet. Glenn Moody on his blog has some further comments, and I think was one of the first that I've seen to suggest that Google suspected or knew that ultimately the Chinese government was behind this attack. So what on the surface would seem unrelated, why would even a wider espionage effort from unknown sources from that part of the world cause them to take such drastic action? This is the reasoning that he applies, and it makes a certain amount of sense. Warning the activist community and alerting affected account holders also, along with hardening the systems in question, really, that would have been enough had this just been one of these other sorts of attacks that Google says is pretty much par for the course. Only that act of communicating to activists that might have been affected required them to actually go public. Otherwise, they could have kept everything under wraps, like many of the other companies apparently did. Moody also sees this in a broader context, that the West, in many cases, made a lot of Google-like compromises to accept some constraints and limitations for much the same reasons, the perception of the importance of the Chinese economy. He wonders if Google's new stance will encourage others to be less tolerant of China's ever-increasing human rights abuses. There's another piece at O'Reilly's Radar site that has a pretty good roundup. I think if you want more editorial and opinion, what Max Slocum has done there is quite good. They do, on the whole, tend to be a bit more cynical, though, viewing Google's actions as a negotiating tactic, saying that they're not really genuinely moving to pull out, but trying to utilize the situation to force a better deal. I actually tend to side more with Glenn Moody that compromising in human rights is not and should not be necessary to cooperate in this market. So I hope that, you know, if it is any sort of a negotiating tack, that Google takes a much harder line and is unyielding on that point, at least. And maybe they'll negotiate other aspects, but I would hope not that one. China seems to view the West's stance towards free speech with, I guess not surprisingly, a certain amount of hypocrisy. And I actually think the same could be said, though, in response of China with their stance towards the free market. It is time to really press them on all aspects of their cultural development instead of supporting their economy and turning a blind eye to the rest. Wired also has a very rapid response from China. It's a final link that I'll include in the show notes. And this is that they're basically not going to back down, that they're reiterating their stance that if Google wants to operate in China, this is what they have to do. They have to cooperate with the censorship regime. And it makes me wonder if any of this is going to have a lasting effect. Probably not, since the government seems far from swayed by Google's threats. And realistically, at the end of the day, as many commentators have pointed out, Chinese citizens on the ground already are able to route around the Great Firewall. That's not all of them, mind you. Probably the more technically savvy, the ones that have access to help from outside or to some of the literature that's provided by great groups like the Citizen Media Lab. The point is, it's not impossible to get access to uncensored information. Google's example, though, may encourage others to follow in their footsteps, but I think it's going to take a lot more to overcome all of the momentum and particularly the history that's built up to date before we break the back of this pervasive censorship regime. Boing Boing Corey shared a link to a very thoughtful and interesting essay by Alex Russell looking into the benefits of the ability to view source in a web browser and the potentially endangered future of that capability. Russell contends that view source was necessary but not entirely sufficient to make HTML the dominant application platform it has become. He defines what he means a bit more clearly, that he's being a bit more inclusive, not just the ability to view source itself, but also that the source in question is human readable and easily parsed and has a certain amount of crunch to it, if you will, what he calls semantic-ish markup. He makes a pretty good case of web developers learning by example, and his description actually reminds me of an essay from a couple of years back by David Brin, lamenting the lack of interactive languages like BASIC. And even though Brin was wrong in my opinion, we have Perl and Python and other languages that can be run in an interactive interpretive mode, they both make the same point about the immediacy of changes, being able to iterate more quickly in order to understand how some chunk of code, some recipe or algorithm actually works and is implemented, as opposed to technologies and languages with any kind of intermediate steps like compilation. Russell also contends working with existing code is a quicker path to learning than merely from first principles. I certainly have found that to be true in learning new languages and new systems, and it also explains the wider popularity of code cookbooks, of code formulas and recipes on the web and collected up in print as often as not. He makes several other lesser but important points, that the cost and barrier to entry is kept low, that you just need a browser, all browsers have ViewSource built in, and a text editor in order to make changes and view them immediately in your browser. Also, because HTML parsing has been notoriously lenient, it makes it very forgiving of mistakes as a developer learns. The flip side of that resiliency, though, is some ambiguity in the rendering and parsing. These are the differences in behavior that we see across browsers, and as he points out, even in many cases, different versions of the very same browser. He seems to be implying that this is kind of the threat, that this maybe is the pressure that's driving developers to code-only solutions like Flash or even GWT. Even for the code-oriented tools that output HTML, JavaScript, and CSS straight up, viewing source becomes less useful. It's not the canonical view of behaviors or some programmatic aspect of a web application. I am surprised he also didn't throw in minifying JavaScript, because that's also a common practice. Maybe it's not as easy to explain or as comprehensive as these sort of coding suites. Minifying is just the practice of running a JavaScript through a post-processor to make it more compact, so the file is smaller at the expense of readabilities. If every page has to load or cache a very large library like jQuery or a prototype or XJS or something like that, minifying it really helps reduce that bandwidth hit, that load time hit. The silver lining to all of this, in his opinion, is that HTML5 in particular and CSS3, the latest version of the presentational aspect of modern markup, may be catching up to these code-only solutions. I think there's merit to his suggestion that these code-only tools provide a sort of to-do list of what future markup needs to support and provide to application developers. There's another alternative that Richard Stallman, of all people, actually proposed, a standard for quote-unquote source distribution for web applications, like sort of like what libraries like jQuery do in a de facto manner today, that the minified and source versions, the human-readable versions of those libraries, share sort of the same base file name. People know how to tweak the file name in order to download the human-readable version or tweak it the other way to get the more efficient minified version. This doesn't get past Russell's objection that source access is a bolt-on for anything other than markup-driven applications. I think there's another layer he missed, too, in terms of readable markup. He admits to glossing over server-side concerns, so maybe he was thinking of that, how such dynamic source generation on the server can result in far less readable source code in the browser. This is all really worth thinking about, though. As much as he may have oversimplified things, left things out, he in his preamble says this really is just get a discussion going. There's no reason, in my opinion, that server-side developers couldn't focus on client-side readability as a priority. I know as I've built frameworks over the years, I've striven for that as an outcome. Really, that's all that he's calling for is recognition of the benefit of this sort of behavior to source code transparency and ways that we can preserve that moving forward. The last story I have is an Ars piece that covers some developments that may lead to a possible future where you could build your very own laptop out of standardized off-the-shelf components. According to Ari Allen Feuer, this actually is an initiative from Shuttle. Shuttle is known for designing, producing small form factor PCs and components. The idea is to push a standard for laptop components called the Shuttle PCB Assembly, or SPA. This would be aimed at the lower end of the portable market, which is facing immense pressure from the big name vendors like HP and Dell. The benefit is pretty straightforward. Smaller laptop makers save money not having to design custom bits to put into their offerings. Eventually, any number of suppliers could produce parts to the SPA standard such that it reduces further the costs of OEMs by bringing in that commoditization effect. By proposing the standard and being the first, one assumes that Shuttle would feel they'd have a better position initially in this market as it develops. Judging by their remarks in the piece, they're clearly thinking of the existing market in traditional desktops and servers, where there is room for many more players, including low-volume commodity OEMs, not just the big brand names that we all recognize. They also admit to the possibility, what I find most exciting, that eventually this system could allow an individual to source their own laptop parts and build a completely custom portable computer. The article has tons of examples from hardware that Shuttle was actually demoing. These are real components that are ready to ship today. They were demonstrating them, as I said, at the Consumer Electronics Show, CES, earlier this month. This includes standardized connectors, add-in boards, and easy access cases, among others. They could even, lower the cost of maintenance, leading to better warranties, perhaps, from some OEMs to be more competitive, or more compelling aftermarket service opportunities. Alan Feuer points out that this has been tried before. This is not entirely novel. Shuttle thinks it actually has licked the killer problems that have prevented past offerings. That is, custom engineering is still predominant in portables because it allows for squeezing more into the constrained spaces of laptops and allows outfits to better address thermal management, which is a key issue. That you can't just have heat radiating willy-nilly from anywhere. You don't want it coming out of the keyboard, for instance. You want to redirect heat flow to where it's more comfortable to the operator and safer to the components. Shuttle thinks that they have solved these problems, as I say, and we'll see as these actually hit the market and we actually start to see real-life systems that use them, and I think especially also as they wear over time. It is early yet, admittedly, for SPA, and Shuttle admits to just focusing for the time being on the OEM opportunity, not necessarily on the end consumer, but it really is hard to ignore that longer-term, very exciting potential. Some of the stories that catch my attention during the week are actually continuations of stories or themes that I've talked about before, and I like to set aside a little extra time to go over those and follow up. The first follow-up is just news that the discussion that I had a few weeks ago about iconography for free, Libre, and open source licensing is continuing. Some of the same folks at Free Software Foundation Europe are still further developing and refining these. And I'll have a link to this in the show notes, what appears to be an expansion in some cases. They've actually added a few terms, one for the Faro clause of the AGPL, that is the triggering of the copy left provision, the share and share alike, by network access, not just distribution of programs, and also a general icon for calling attention to surprising or unusual licensing elements, really trying to identify where the potential a licensor would need to dig into and understand a more nuanced license a little more closely. The matrix of licenses also that they've applied these icons to has been considerably expanded. Randall Schwartz actually wrote a comment on my website in response to my initial discussion of this, to note in particular that they, in their initial take, got the artistic license backwards. He writes, "Thanks for bringing the badging SFSFE post to my awareness. I noted on their blog that they got Perl's artistic license backwards, lumping it in with author retains rights that no contributor can have, licenses like the GPL, rather than author gives all his rights up to any willing contributor licenses like BSD, MIT, Apache family. While there are a few minor restrictions in the artistic license, namely that you cannot modify a distribution without making it clear that you are distributing a modified copy, it's very close to the BSD license. Hopefully they'll correct alignment before you read this." They didn't correct the original post, Randall, but they did actually correct this update to it. And as I understand it, the new version of this grid that I'll link to better matches Randall's suggestion. They, though, have also added a warning sign to the artistic license with a comment to the effect that that license could be interpreted or could be set up to be either a free software license or a not strictly free software license. So you may still want to review that, Randall, and provide further feedback to guide that in. And hopefully folks who have a stake with some of the other licenses that they mentioned are paying closer attention to this as well. I think overall, this refinement still also serves as a pretty good starting point. They do admit in the preamble before they set up all the iconography and the various matrices that you may need or want to read the licenses themselves just to use this effort solely as kind of an overview to guide which ones you actually want to dig into. The icons are, after all, still at best a reduction, even with the slight expansion in this latest iteration of the idea. The last story I want to follow up on is some better news, not the best news in the world, but that the British government is agreeing to water down certain aspects of the problematic digital economy bill. And I'll include a link to Michael Geist's posts on this. One of the more troubling parts of this bill is Clause 17. This is the one that would reserve new powers to the business minister, a sort of blank check to rewrite future copyright law. This is a bad idea, but undertaken with the notion to try to future-proof the bill to deal with copyright problems not yet understood. I would argue that the British government, among other governments, doesn't understand current problems and solutions in this copyright space. There has certainly been criticism, thankfully, from within the government and from concerned private parties, most notably from within the tech industry. This makes sense, the latter source of criticism, as innovations are the ones most likely to run afoul of this clause to trigger the change in contours of copyright law in Britain. The authors of the bill are trying to offer a compromise, a 60-day consultation before implementing any new powers. This would explicitly involve consumer groups in the discussion, and there would also be some sort of evidential test, a requirement to show harm. And really, like many of these sorts of suboptimal compromises, my only thought on this is, why don't they just remove the clause and rely on the ability to pass new legislation as things actually happen, instead of building in something that could so easily be abused for the worst purposes? And the only answer really is just the lobby interest is money. Is it somebody's got a hold of Lord Mandelson and the other proponents of this bill to try to make it easier for them to stifle innovation, to regulate the market the way that it is? Hopefully, this, as it evolves, will either strip out much more aggressively these problematic powers. It's possible. The Digital Economy Bill is seeing very active discussion right now. There are quite a few provisions in the offing, quite a few amendments. So it would be some time before that settles down and we have some idea what the final nature of this bill might be. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the program, please go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for information on how you can help by making a donation, purchasing some swag, or downloading a promo in order to help spread the word. Of course, you can also always just tell a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, you can call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show, which should be out in the feed Wednesday night, will include the fantastic interview I conducted with Danny O'Brien of EFF. Can't wait to share that. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Liberated Syndication and Wouta DeBee for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits, and permission to recycle those further, except where noted, is granted under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike 3.0 United States license. That means you're allowed to change and share this file as long as you share your changes, maintain attribution, and don't commercialize it without permission.